You know how sometimes you just wish someone could explain a really complex idea to you without making you feel like you need a PhD?
Yeah, like give me the insights without all the jargon.
Right. Well, that's kind of what we do here on the Deep Dive. We take these huge topics, and in about the time it takes you to finish that first cup of coffee, we try to pull out the truly fascinating bits.
The stuff that makes you go, huh, that's interesting.
Exactly. And today we're going to be talking about something that I think really fits that bill. We're going to be looking at a connection, a really unexpected one, between two scientific models that seem totally unrelated at first glance.
It's the kind of connection that once you see it, it makes a whole bunch of other things suddenly click into place.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, so that's how that works.
Precisely. You've brought us a fascinating paper from way back in 1952 by T.D. Lee and C.N. Yang. It's called Statistical Theory of Equations of State and Phase Transitions, Part 2, Lattice Gas and Ising Model. And it was published in the prestigious journal Physical Review.
And this paper, I gotta say, it's not exactly light reading.
Oh, definitely not. But it lays out this really surprising mathematical equivalence between the Ising model and the lattice gas model.
So our deep dive today is going to be about unpacking that connection. We'll talk about the Ising model, which is all about magnetism, and the lattice gas model, which, as you might guess, is all about how gases behave.
And the really cool thing is that by understanding one of these models, we automatically gain deep insights into the other, especially when it comes to phase transitions, things like a gas condensing into a liquid or a material suddenly becoming magnetic.
Okay, so let's start by sketching out a picture of each model.
All right, so imagine you have a checkerboard.
Got it. I can picture that.
Now, in the Ising model, at each square of this checkerboard, we have a tiny little arrow or a spin. The spin can point either up or down.
Okay, so each square on the board is like a miniature compass needle, and whether it points up or down depends on, like, what its neighbors are doing and whether there's any kind of external magnetic force acting on it, right?
Exactly. So in this model, we have several key players. There's J, which tells us how strongly neighboring spins want to line up with each other.
Like how much they attract or repel each other.
Right. Then there's H, which is the external magnetic field. This field tries to force all the spins to point in the same direction.
Got it.
Then we have F, which represents the free energy per spin. This is essentially a measure of the overall energy balance of the system. N is simply the total number of these tiny spins on our checkerboard. And then importantly, there's the interaction energy between neighboring spins, which is related to a constant E.
And this E determines whether the spins want to align with each other or go in opposite directions.
Exactly. If he's positive, we have a ferromagnetic interaction, meaning the spins prefer to point the same way. But if he is negative, it's an anti-ferromagnetic interaction, meaning they want to alternate their directions.
Okay, so that's our world of tiny interacting magnetic arrows. What about the lattice gas model? How does our checkerboard picture change in that case?
Well, in the lattice gas model, instead of spins at each square, we have atoms. Or more precisely, each square or latticeite can either be empty or it can be occupied by an atom of our gas.
So instead of a spin pointing up or down, we have an atom present or absent. It's still a kind of binary state, like you were saying.
Exactly. And in this model, we also have several key quantities to keep track of. There's V, which stands for the total volume of the container holding our gas. Then there's N, which represents the total number of gas atoms, and V, which is the specific volume, telling us how much space each atom has on average.
Okay, makes sense.
We also have P for pressure, which is the force the gas exerts on its container. And then there's U, which stands for fugacity.
Fugacity. That one sounds a bit technical.
Yeah, it can be a bit tricky to wrap your head around, but basically, fugacity tells us how much the gas wants to add or remove particles. It's a more sophisticated way of talking about pressure and the chemical potential of the gas.
Okay, I think I get the general idea.
Now, the key thing here is that there is a potential energy between the atoms, and this energy depends on how close they are to each other.
Okay, tell me more about that.
So, if two atoms try to be on the same lattice site at the same time, the potential energy between them is infinity. Which makes sense because atoms can't occupy the same space.
Right, they can't just overlap.
Exactly. Now, if two atoms are on neighboring sites, the potential energy between them is negus 2e. So if he's positive, just like in our ferromagnetic case in the Ising model, then the atoms attract each other.
Ah, that's interesting. So this potential with its hardcore repulsion when atoms are on top of each other and its attraction when they're close by, that actually sounds like a pretty good approximation of how real gas atoms interact.
Exactly. The paper points out that this potential captures the essential features of the forces between real atoms with their repulsive cores and their short-range attractive forces. And this is why this seemingly simple lattice gas model can actually give us some really deep insights into real-world phenomena, like gases condensing into liquids.
Okay, so we've got these two pictures in our minds. A grid of magnetic spins and a grid of gas atoms. But how on earth are these two things mathematically equivalent? It feels like we're comparing apples and oranges from completely different universes.
Yeah, at first glance, they seem totally unrelated. But that's what makes this paper so remarkable. Li and Yang were able to show that there's a direct one-to-one mapping between the configurations of spins in the Ising model and the configurations of atoms in the lattice gas.
Wait, really? How does that even work?
So picture it like this. If a spin is pointing up in the Ising model, that corresponds to an empty site on the lattice in the gas model. And if the spin is pointing down, that's like having an atom at that site.
Huh, that's clever.
Uh-huh.
So if we had a lattice where all the spins were pointing down, that would be like a lattice that's completely packed with gas atoms.
Exactly. And this one-to-one mapping between their configurations allows us to translate directly between the mathematical equations that describe each model.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this could be really powerful. But can we go into a bit more detail about how specific quantities map onto each other?
Absolutely. The paper actually includes a handy table that lays out these correspondences. For example, the total number of downward spins in the Ising model is equal to the total number of atoms in the lattice gas.
And what about the overall strength of the magnetism in the Ising model? How does that relate to the gas?
Well, the intensity of magnetization, denoted by I, is directly related to the specific volume V of the gas through a simple equation.
So the density of the gas, which is a pretty basic property, is directly linked to the magnetic state of a seemingly unrelated system. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's a great example of how seemingly different physical systems can be governed by similar underlying mathematical principles.
Now, what about fugacity? How does that map onto the Ising model?
The fugacity of the gas is related to the external magnetic field H and the interaction energy E of the Ising model through an exponential function. It's a bit more complicated than the other correspondences, but essentially it means that changing the magnetic field strength in the Ising model is equivalent to changing how many atoms the gas wants to have.
That makes sense. And what about pressure?
Ah, pressure. This is where it gets really interesting. The pressure P of the gas is directly related to the free energy per spin F of the Ising lattice, again, through a relatively simple equation.
So if we can calculate the free energy of our magnetic system, we automatically know the pressure of the equivalent gas.
Precisely. It's like having a dictionary that lets you translate directly between the languages of magnetism and gases.
Okay, so this equivalence is pretty mind-blowing already.
Yeah.
But you mentioned earlier that it becomes especially profound when we talk about phase transitions.
Right. So imagine what happens when the magnetization of the Ising model suddenly jumps, like when a material becomes ferromagnetic below a certain temperature. This jump corresponds directly to a sudden change in the specific volume of the lattice gas.
And a sudden change in volume, that's like a gas condensing into a liquid, right?
Exactly. And that critical temperature at which the magnetization jumps, the Curie temperature, is mathematically identical to the critical temperature at which the gas starts to condense.
So the Ising model's transition to a ferromagnetic state is like the gas's transition to a liquid state.
Precisely. Above the critical temperature, both systems behave smoothly. But below it, they undergo these dramatic transformations, and the mathematics of those transformations is mirrored in both models.
And the paper actually goes into some detail about the specifics of these transitions in the lattice gas, right? Like the vapor pressure and the densities of the gas and liquid phases.
Yes, it does. Because the 2D Ising model had already been solved exactly for zero magnetic field, thanks to some brilliant work by Onsager and Yang, Li and Yang were able to use these results to map out the exact behavior of the corresponding 2D lattice gas. They were able to calculate things like the vapor pressure and the specific volumes of the liquid and gas phases in equilibrium. They even provided specific formulas for these quantities, all expressed in terms of a parameter related to temperature and the interaction energy E.
So they were essentially using the already solved mathematics of the Ising model as a tool to crack the more complex problem of gas-liquid transitions.
Exactly. And they even plotted these results in a diagram showing the exact region where the gas and liquid phases coexist and how the pressure and volume change along different isotherms.
I see. The paper also mentioned something called the law of constant diameter in the 2D lattice gas model. What's that all about?
So in their model, if you take the average of the gas density and the liquid density in equilibrium, this average turns out to be a constant independent of temperature. Which is interesting because in real gases, this average density usually increases slightly as the temperature goes down.
Ah, so the model captures the general idea of a relationship between average density and temperature, but it doesn't quite match the exact behavior of real gases.
Right. And Li and Yang suggested that this discrepancy probably comes from the fact that their model is discrete with a fixed lattice spacing, whereas a real gas is continuous.
It's a reminder that models are simplifications of reality, and they always have limitations.
For sure. Now, the paper also goes into some pretty advanced math, talking about something called the grand partition function and its roots in the complex plane.
Oh, yeah. That part definitely went over my head.
Well, it's a bit technical, but the key idea is that this grand partition function is like a master key that unlocks all the thermodynamic information about the system. And the roots of this function, the places where it becomes zero, tell us a lot about how the system behaves, especially near phase transitions.
Okay, following so far.
So Li and Yang came up with this amazing theorem about the location of these roots. They proved that for a certain type of interaction, which is actually very general and includes both ferromagnetic Ising models and realistic lattice gases, all the roots of the grand partition function lie on a circle in the complex plane.
On a circle? That sounds incredibly specific.
It is, and it has some pretty profound implications. For example, it means that these systems can have at most one phase transition. And it also tells us about the convergence of certain mathematical series that we use to describe the behavior of gases.
Okay. So this theorem is about a lot more than just circles in the complex plane. It actually has direct implications for how we understand the real world.
Exactly. The paper also introduces a really cool analogy between the distribution of these roots on the circle and an electrostatic charge distribution on a cylinder.
Wait, hold on. Electrostatic charges. How does that fit in?
It's an analogy, but it helps us visualize what's going on. So imagine a cylinder whose cross-section is a circle. Now imagine that this circle is covered with electrical charges, and the density of those charges varies around the circle.
Okay, I can picture that.
So the electric field created by this charge distribution is mathematically analogous to the density of our gas. And a sudden jump in the electric field, which would happen if the charge density suddenly changed, corresponds to a phase transition, like condensation.
So the way the charges are distributed on the circle tells us how the gas behaves.
Exactly. And there's this function called GUT that describes the density of those charges, and the value of this function at the point where the phase transition happens is directly related to the difference in densities between the gas and liquid phases.
So this function G holds the key to understanding the details of the phase transition.
In a way, yes. It tells us how abruptly the system changes as we cross the critical point.
Fascinating. The paper also mentions that this G function is related to some other quantities that show up in the study of gases, like cluster integrals.
Right. The cluster integrals tell us about the interactions between groups of atoms, and they're mathematically linked to the Fourier coefficients of the G function. So, in principle, we could experimentally measure these cluster integrals and use them to learn about the underlying mathematical structure of the system.
Okay, to wrap things up, I want to make sure I'm getting the big picture here. What are the most important takeaways from this deep dive into Li and Yang's work?
The big takeaway is that there's this profound mathematical connection between the Ising model, which is all about magnetism, and the lattice gas model, which describes gases. And this connection provides a really powerful framework for understanding phase transitions, like a gas condensing into a liquid or a material becoming magnetic.
And that theorem about the roots of the grand partition function lying on a circle, that seems particularly important.
Absolutely. It tells us that a huge class of physical systems, even seemingly unrelated ones, share a very specific and elegant mathematical property. And it suggests that there might be even deeper, more fundamental principles at play that we haven't fully grasped yet.
It makes you wonder what other hidden connections might be out there, just waiting to be discovered. Maybe there are other systems that we can map onto a lattice or think of in terms of binary states. And by doing so, we can unlock a whole new level of understanding.
It's certainly a possibility. Maybe think about what systems or phenomena in your own field of interest might exhibit these types of properties. You never know what kind of surprising connections you might find.
Well, this has been a mind-bending journey through some truly groundbreaking work. Huge thanks to you for taking us through it. And to our listeners, if you're feeling extra adventurous and want to explore this topic further, I highly recommend checking out the original paper by Lian Yang. It's a challenging read, but well worth the effort if you're curious about the deep mathematical connections that underpin the behavior of our universe. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.